So yeah, I'll tell you about some work I've recently done with Mark Strednicki at UC Santa Barbara. And it's about connections between the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis and the entanglement structure of generic excited eigenstates of chaotic many-body systems. That's the first part. And that's contained in this recent paper on the archive. And also connections between eigenstate thermalization hypothesis and out-of-time order correlators in the bound-on chaos. And that's, you can find that in this paper also in the archive. So first, I want to start by motivating and describing ETH a little bit. So there's a nice review of ETH and related things by D'Alessio, Marco Strigol, Polkovnikov, a few others. And I recommend it if you're interested in reading more. Okay. So the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is basically one answer to the question of how you get effectively thermal behavior in systems with microscopic deterministic dynamics. This is an old question. It's kind of surprising to me that this only became an issue in quantum mechanics, because actually there's the same problem in classical mechanics as well. So to motivate ETH, I want to talk about its classical version, which is perhaps less commonly talked about. But this actually, this is an old idea. It goes back to Kinchin, the mathematician Kinchin. In his StatMech book in the 40s, he already had this idea. So imagine I have some classical system with phase space. And energy is conserved, so the dynamics happens on some surface in phase space of constant energy. There's a point in phase space that represents my system at a given instant of time. And this moves around in some deterministic way. Right? And then I have some observable A, which is a function of the momenta and the coordinates. It's a function on phase space. And its instantaneous value is its value at the point of the system, right? So now imagine this system is ergodic in the classical sense. So eventually, this point will explore the whole constant energy surface. The timescale over which that happens is far too long to be meaningful. So it cannot explain why statistical mechanics actually works on physical timescales. The only reasonable explanation is that this function, any function representing an observable, has to be a special kind of function. So it has to be nearly constant on every constant energy surface with small local fluctuations. And the only effect of the dynamics is to take you off an initially atypical point. So I would call this classical ETH. It's a statement about the functions representing observables rather than a statement about the dynamics independent of observables. So the quantum version of this is again a statement about observables. And here's the ETH ansatz.
Here you said classically, it's because the observable has some property which is independent of the dynamics.
It's not independent of the dynamics. So the dynamics has to do something. It has to take you away from atypical values of the observable.
Now suppose I change the Hamiltonian, but I fix this observable as a fixed function of p and q, and I change the Hamiltonian. Will I go to a regime where ETH, classical ETH, just breaks down?
Yeah, so for instance, if you go to a fully integrable system where the dynamics is on tori, right, nested tori in phase space, then this function might have a value on a given torus that's very different from its value on the full constant energy surface.
But in my ideology, I feel integrable systems are real. So in most occasions, I will have classical ETH. That's to say, if I tune my Hamiltonian, usually I get ETH.
Sure, yeah, I think that's reasonable. All I'm saying is that ergodicity by itself, even in the classical case, is not enough to explain the success of statistical mechanics.
But does this explanation really explain the success of statistical mechanics and is concrete? How good is it, this explanation?
I don't know. This is motivation. So I'm just saying that something like this has to be true. All I'm trying to motivate is the fact that it's both too strong and too weak to insist on ergodicity. You have to say something about physical observables. And that's kind of the ideology of ETH in the quantum case. So okay, in the quantum case, we have some Hamiltonian describing the system. And we have its eigenstates. And the ansatz is about, well, it says if I have an observable A, which is usually local or few body, it should have a particular structure in the energy eigenstate basis. So let me just write it down and then I'll explain all of the pieces. So it has a diagonal piece. A of E is some smooth function of energy. E is the mean energy of the two eigenstates in question. Omega is their energy difference. So there's some smooth function on the diagonal. And then there are exponentially small off-diagonal terms. Here, S of E is the thermodynamic entropy at energy E. So you can compute that in any ensemble that you like, energy, microcanonical, canonical with the corresponding temperature, so on. This F is some smooth function of it, both its arguments that will control dynamics. And R is a matrix of order one erratically varying numbers. So F is also order one. This sets the size. For some purposes, it's okay to treat R as a Gaussian random variable. The different elements of R is independent Gaussian random variables with mean zero and variance one. But for some purposes, like computing the OTOC, it's wrong to do that. Okay. So this is the ansatz. So why, yeah.
Just because so Rij has diagonal pieces.
It does, yeah, it does. So you can think, if I look at, let's say I look at diagonal elements and look at neighboring ones. So in one eigenstate and the next eigenstate. This function does not change at all between those two. Because the energy is the same, basically. So ETH is saying that the difference in the value of an observable between neighboring eigenstates is extremely small. OK, so just why does this help answer questions about thermalization? Well, the diagonal part tells you that the late time value is the thermal value. So this is equal to the thermal value definition.
Wait, so far you haven't said anything about time. This is just a property of the
eigenstate. Right, right. But if, so now, if I prepare the system in some initial state, and then compute the instantaneous value of this observable as a function of time, at sufficiently late times, the diagonal part will survive. Or if I compute a time average, the diagonal part will survive. And that will be equal to the thermal expectation value because this is the thermal value. Okay. The off-diagonal elements being small basically is necessary to ensure that it relaxes to the thermal value for all reasonable initial states. And you can figure out how small it has to be by saying that A squared is another reasonable observable. And if I compute A squared using this ansatz for A, I'll get a contribution from the cross term, right? I'll get a contribution from the square of this term. And there'll be a sum over intermediate states in that contribution. And there are e to the s states in a small energy window, right? So in order to get an order one contribution to this quantity, this term has to be order e to the minus s over 2. So that basically fixes the magnitude of the off-diagonal term. Okay.
Sorry, a silly question. And just from this structure of the matrix element, can I see the off-diagonal piece will vanish in the non-time limit?
If you're willing to go to very long times, yeah. So let's say I compute I have a diagonal piece. Well, plus some exponentially small thing. So at time zero, these coefficients were chosen so that this term is large because we're starting out of equilibrium, right? As time progresses, these will dephase in some way. Eventually, they'll decay to zero. So this can be made more precise, and it is. I mean, you can find references in this paper and older work by Mark.
What assumption do we need for f? For this to happen?
F has to be a smooth function of its arguments. Well, you don't need too many conditions on F. So I'll derive some conditions on F later. Okay. All right, so I'm going to just take this as input for everything else that I do. Yeah, so for the rest of the talk, I'm going to regard ETH as a fact. Okay. And we can discuss later whether that's reasonable or not. It's been numerically verified in small systems, and I don't know if it's possible to analytically verify it. If someone has ideas, I'd be interested. Okay. All right, any more questions about the ETH stuff? All right. So here I want to go back to an old problem by something considered by Don Page, which is, what is the entanglement structure of a random, high random state? So let's say I have some system which is split into two parts, one and two. So the Hilbert space is a product. And I pick some state at random from this. In general, I can expand it in a basis. Of 1 and 2. Here I and j are just any orthonormal basis of the two parts. And you can compute its reduced density matrix. So its reduced density matrix of system 1 is this. System 2, it's this. Right? So these have the same non-zero eigenvalues. One of them has extra zero eigenvalues, whichever one belongs to the larger Hilbert space. On average, so if you average over Haar measure here, they're proportional to the identity. Here, D is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So this follows simply because there's no preferred basis. Right? And the fluctuations are very small around this. So you can compute an entanglement entropy, average entanglement entropy, and show that it's maximal. It's just the log of the dimension. The Hilbert space is as large as it can be. And then there's a correction. So this correction is completely negligible except when the two systems are the same size, and then it's 1/2. Okay. So we can plot this. Let me plot. So here, V is just the log of the Hilbert space dimension. If I had some real system with elementary degrees of freedom, V would be kind of the number or the volume. Right. So this is called the page curve often. So it's maximal, and then at exactly half system size, there's a a little lower than maximal. Okay. So what I want to talk about now is what happens if you don't take a state at random, but instead we have some Hamiltonian.
This experience seems like it's not symmetric between d1 and d2.
Right. So this is for maybe I should write it like this. Let me make it symmetric. Yeah. So I don't need to put a 1 here. Actually, it's the same for both. Right. So now imagine that my Hamiltonian, I have a Hamiltonian for the system that's H1 acts in system 1, H2 acts in system 2, and H12 couples them. And it's some local Hamiltonian that obeys ETH. And let me pick these I's and J's to be eigenstates of the corresponding Hamiltonians. And now I want to take an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian and express it in this basis. Okay, and then I can go through the same set of steps and ask, what does the entanglement entropy look like? So and it turns out that it's quite interesting. So here is V1 again. Here's V. V2, 0. So now what happened, two things happen. One is that the slope is lower. So the maximal value that it goes to is actually the thermodynamic entropy at that energy. So you can think of this as the thermodynamic entropy at infinite temperature, right, where the density matrix is the identity. Here, this is the entropy of a Gibbs state at that energy. Something else happens. This 1/2 actually becomes So here C is the heat capacity. So instead of a minus 1/2, here you actually get a minus square root of volume. Correction.
Is this something you can show? Or?
Yeah, this is something I can show. So in fact, I will show this in like 10 minutes. And it persists over a region of width square root V as well. In general, there are also order A corrections to the entanglement entropy that you can think of as, you know, in the ground state, you have an area law for entanglement. That kind of survives to higher energies as well. So there will be order A terms. Those are model dependent, and I can't say anything general about them. This is a kind of universal correction that's always there for systems that obey ATH. That's a claim. This also, there's a similar correction if you have more conserved quantities. So if you have a conserved particle number, this becomes some sum of elements in a matrix of capacities. And that's actually been checked numerically. So Marcos Rigol and Lev Widmar have a paper where they found square root of V correction, just numerically. And you can check that what they found, if you take their leading term, so C is related to the second derivative of S, just by thermodynamics, right? So if you take the coefficient of the leading term as a function of energy and compute its second derivative and plug it in, you actually get the subleading correction in their computation.
So, excuse
yeah.
me, so you are showing ETH in what sense, H or both H1 and H2?
All three. All three cells are ETH.
So H1, 2 can be exaggerated. The coupling.
H1, 2 has to be non-zero, but.
Non-zero so that H is ETH.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be very large because, you know, this is an excited eigenstate. So the level spacing in the middle of the spectrum is exponentially small. So even if H1, 2 is exponentially small, it can still scramble levels. Okay.
I don't know if it's important, but do we have to assume some kind of no phase transition assumption?
Oh yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so I'm assuming that C is finite. So presumably at a thermal phase transition, this can diverge as some power of system size that's not one, right? There's some critical exponent associated with C. So it might be a larger suppression, I don't know. The problem is the order area term will depend on some correlation length generally. That also diverges at a phase transition. So I don't know which of those effects is more important.
But just to, for safe, we just assume no phase transition for the entire spectrum, on the entire temperature? Or?
No, you can just pick, you just sit at an energy density at which there is no phase transition.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so there's a technical claim which I probably won't prove. I'll just state it and explain why it should be true. Oh. Okay, so the claim is that for an energy eigenstate, this matrix M looks kind of like this. So S is again the thermodynamic entropy. F is some window function that keeps the sum of the two energies close to the total energy, right? As it should. It has mean zero, maybe center, and width delta, where delta is given by this. Oh, sorry, here I've shifted. So I assume that H12, the expectation value in the energy eigenstate is zero. So if it's not, you can just subtract this from H12 and add it to H1 and H2. So F is this window function, and for the purpose of computing bulk quantities, C can be approximated as a Gaussian random variable with mean zero and variance one. And in D greater than equal to two dimensions, F is Gaussian. Okay, so let me justify this structure. So let me just compute the norm of E. So this should be one, right? So if I just insert this form, this is we can replace this with one. And then, so the only reason I'm going through this calculation is because this is the only technical calculation that appears in all of the things I'll say. It's basically a very trivial calculation, but I need to do it once. So you can, everything else in the sum is a smoothly varying function of E. So it can replace these sums over states by integrals over energies with the appropriate densities of states. Limit that delta goes to zero, F is a delta function. And in that limit, we have this integral. And this is indeed one, because basically this is the integral, and that's exactly counting how many states there are at energy E, right? So this is number of states in system one at energy E1 times number of states in system two at the remaining energy, basically. Okay.
Delta is always an odd number.
Right, okay, so actually delta will turn out to be order square root of area. You're right, it's not zero, but it's small, And it's small relative to the scale on which these S's change significantly. So in general, delta is not zero, but it's small enough that the distribution of the difference of E1 plus E2 minus E is controlled completely by F. Okay. So we can Taylor expand these entropies around this value and then compute with that.
Where does
dimensionality
enter?
Yeah, so okay, I'm just getting to that now. So now let me, by following the same steps, you can compute moments of this quantity. And show that they're basically the moments of F. Okay. And computing this for n equals 1 and 2 recovers these properties of F. You can also compute them for higher n and relate them to moments of h1, 2 to the n because of this. So h1 plus h2 is h minus h1, 2. There's an h minus e here. Kind of see that it'll be related to a moment of h. H1, 2 is a sum of terms. So here's the boundary between system 1 and 2. H1, 2 is a sum of terms acting along the boundary. Right? And I'm computing some expectation of value of it in an eigenstate. ETH says that that expectation value is the same as the thermal expectation value of that quantity. And for a thermal state, we know that there's some correlation length, and correlations factorize beyond that correlation length, right? So the dominant contribution to H1, 2 to the n will be where the different densities are kind of paired up and factorized, moving freely. And that's characteristic of a Gaussian distribution. So this is the argument that this window function F is Gaussian in two or more dimensions.
Do we know anything about D equals to 1?
No. So in D equals 1, the most you can say is this. These two statements are still true. And that's it. So, I mean, these arguments are presented more carefully in the top paper. Okay, but given this, you can compute row 1.
Sir?
Yeah.
Another silly question. We'll say the inner product of E is 1 because of that integral.
Mm-hmm.
Classically, I understand why that's 1, but quantum mechanically, H1 and H2 may not be simultaneously
analyzable.
Why is...
Oh, no, sorry, I should... S1 is just the thermodynamic entropy of system 1 at energy E1. It's just a number.
Then by assuming ETH, then...
So this S1 and S2 appear because they're just the densities of states of systems 1 and 2. So I just change the sum over I to an integral over its energy with the density of states. That's it. So what, I just made this replacement. Right, because well, I claim that this is basically true. So this is just counting states, basically. Right, this is the density of states of the full system in energy E. I can multiply it by some dE to get a number. Right, and how can I get that? I can get that by partitioning the energy between systems one and two. And I just look at the total number of states, which is this times this, and integrate over the energies.
This is just the classical counting, right?
Yeah, it's just classical counting.
Why is it still true in quantum case?
I mean, the S is it's just thermodynamic entropy, which is density of states. I mean, log of density of states.
But assuming ETH is true.
I don't think you have to assume ETH for this. You know, if I just do thermodynamics in a quantum system, the
entropy. I just want to assume that given a eigenstate of the whole system, it can be read as the product state of two eigenstates of the subsystem. Something like that.
No. So this.
Otherwise, you don't have a one-to-one mapping of states.
No, so you don't need a one-to-one mapping of states. This is just densities of states.
For counting the number, you need into some one-to-one map, right?
No, sorry. Maybe I'm not understanding the confusion.
Some kind of a product principle to get the whole number of something. You divide it by two cases, and the first
right.
map.
Right.
Then you have to assume that one to one map between the otherwise depends how you run counting.
Sure. So okay, you agree that energy in system one and energy in system two are well defined, and energy of the full system is also defined.
Okay.
Right. In the limit that delta goes to zero, energy of the full system equals the energy of the one system plus the energy of the other. Okay. Right. If delta is not going to zero, there's a small difference, which is that delta, right?
Just the last equation in the lower blackboard. This equation, if delta is not going to zero, is it true?
Oh, this is just true. Okay. I mean, okay, you might have to modify these S's by a tiny amount, but at leading order and volume, this is true.
Well, I guess you assume the locality of H12, right?
Yeah.
H12 is very non-local. I guess this equation cannot be true.
Yeah, yeah.
So is there implicitly assuming that both 1 and 2 are much larger than the boundary?
Yeah. Which is, I think, reasonable. I mean.
So you're actually implicitly taking some dynamic will be emitted at some step, so
Yeah, all of these are in the thermodynamic limit.
So this is for eigenstate.
Yeah.
So but let's say if I take a random state with it,
I think the result would be the same.
The same, or the
scale is essentially the same. So it's almost saying that an eigenstate is basically like a random state in a given energy shell. Okay. But okay. Anyway, the precise form of F is not going to be important for anything I do now. So all I want to say is that the reduced density matrix is this product of M's, right? And M is this, has this banded structure. It's banded near the diagonal and with random elements. So if subsystem 1 is smaller than subsystem 2, this matrix row will be almost diagonal. And its eigenvalues, it'll have full rank, and its eigenvalues will be approximately this. Okay, so this is, again, you can just think about this factor is telling you how many states are in the other system at that energy, U1. And this is just normalization. But this can't be true at all energies E1. So at sufficiently high energies E1, there are actually more states in system 1 than in system 2, right? Because the density of states increases with energy. So at some point, this is incorrect. Actually, at sufficiently high energies E1, system 2 should be regarded as a smaller system, and you should compute its reduced density matrix. So the actual result is that the in an energy range we have So does this make sense? This e to the s min of E1 is basically the local in energy Hilbert space dimension of the smaller subsystem, right? So the other density matrix will have extra zero eigenvalues. And this is the value of the typical eigenvalue in the smaller subsystem. So the important point is that this row 1 computed as a function of E1 becomes rank deficient at some energy. And now if you compute the entanglement entropy, which is that, this S max essentially will, that's like an absolute value of energy, right? It has a kink in it. So this will give you a square root correction. Typically, there's some saddle point calculation that you do, and since you're computing a Gaussian integral with an absolute value, you'll get a square root of the variance of the Gaussian. Okay. And I can go over that in more detail if someone wants, but you can also find it in the paper. And I don't know. Does that make any sense to anyone, or should I go over it in more detail?
So this would
what happens is that somehow the difference between the eigenvalues, the value of the eigenvalues, is going to give you the capacity.
Okay, let me just. So let's say we actually just plug in row one. So this is just the density of states of the smaller system times the number of non-zero eigenvalues. This is the number of non-zero eigenvalues times the value of each one. The e to the minus s of e has become the denominator here. And then there's this factor, which is the log of rho 1. These are all extensive quantities. They scale with the system size. So you can expand this around its saddle point and do a Gaussian integral. In general, S of E, so the second derivative, the first derivative of S of E is the temperature. The second derivative is related to the heat capacity, which is thermodynamics. And so eventually you'll get a Gaussian integral here with a 1 over C in front of it. If it happens that this maximum occurs right at the saddle point, then you'll be computing a Gaussian integral of absolute value of deviation from the saddle point. So you'll end up computing something like which will give a square root of c correction. And it turns out that this crossover happens at the saddle point exactly at half system size.
Maybe not important question. Did you set h bar equals to 1 or h equals to 1?
I said h bar equals to 1 and kb equals to 1.
So I can say you said h equals to 1, that 2 pi actually goes away. So it's really capacity. If you define the units correctly, it's good.
I don't know if the 2 pi goes away. There might not be h bars in there, it might just be Boltzmann constants. Maybe there has to be an h bar. I don't know. It's square root of volume. That's the important thing. Yeah.
This much related numerics.
Sorry?
This, you can check numerically.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can. What you can do is this is what Marcos and Lev did. You can just take a system in one dimension with conserved particle number. So pick a state at random and define some, let's say I have fermions on site, and I pick a state at random with n fermions in total.
Why is that important?
Sorry? So here it's not conserved energy, but it's some other conserved quantity. Right. So I just split the system into two. N fermions in total, N1 on this side, N2 on this side, right, define my states. I can again expand my state in the basis, compute the entanglement entropy, and you find at half system size, and I think at half filling as well, the same expression, where now the C is again related to a second derivative of S, this time with respect to the other conserved quantity. Yeah. Sorry? In order to write this as C, you have to assume it, but you can derive everything without assuming it.
We'll say the maximum height at the half partition. Do you need to assume?
That assumes translation symmetry, yeah. There's a more general version which is given in the paper. So the actual condition is that the typical entropies of the two systems should be equal. Okay, and then I guess I was a little slower than I wanted to be. But let me talk about the OTOC now. I have 10 minutes more, maybe?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay. All right, I guess I'll have to be very schematic. This concerns this out-of-time order correlator, which has become some diagnostic of quantum chaos. There's a bound. So okay, there's this quantity. The compute A is an operator. Rho is this thermal density matrix. And there's this interesting regularization of this operator that can be computed. And in some theories, as a function of time, F has this kind of behavior. So on some short time, which we'll call the dissipation time, it decays. And then in some large intermediate time range, it has this exponential behavior, where lambda here is called, it's kind of like a Lyapunov exponent. And Maldacena et al. Derived a bound on lambda. So, called the bound on chaos, in quotes. So this bound can also be derived from ETH. You assume that ETH holds, and also you have to assume a little bit about the functional form of F, and it's possible to derive this bound. So I will try to see how that works in 5 minutes. So the basic idea will be there's some part of this function that decays to zero on very short timescales. Right? So let me subtract that part away and then look at the remainder. So this remainder will be the connected part. You can look at this, the Fourier transform of this quantity. ETH allows you to bound the large omega behavior of this quantity. Okay. And then given some knowledge of the functional form of this side, that bound translates to bound on lambda. That's the basic methodology. So how ETH bounds this is as follows. So let me just look at some thermal expectation value. So inserting the ETH ansatz and following the same kinds of steps I did here, you could show that this is okay. So this left-hand side is some finite number. So in order for this integral to converge, this f has to decay at large omega. Otherwise, this will be dominated by large values of omega. Similarly, you can compute a four-point function. So I can plug the ETH ansatz into this quantity as well. So I'll end up with an expression of the form and then I have to plug in the ETH ansatz for each of these pieces and do some kind of statistical average over the R's. Okay. So in general, you have to do some statistical average of this sort. There are terms in here where the R's are paired up, and those will give one. Basically, so, okay. And then there, so these will cause the function to factorize, essentially, into products of two-point functions. So these terms correspond to what decays quickly on dissipation time. Then there's also some small correlation. And it has to be small because there's an extra sum over states in this term. Again, by requiring some operator to be finite, you can bound the large omega behavior of this g function. So this, in turn, bounds the large omega behavior of the OTOC. Okay, then given a particular functional form, so for instance, let's say f here's a simple functional form. So if you Taylor expand this, you get 1 minus e to the lambda t minus ds, right? And it, at large times, it goes to 0. If you just Fourier transform this and compare it with this, you'll get a bound on lambda.
So why is this form transformable?
This is not. This has actually been used in the approximation by some people. If you use this form, you actually get that lambda should be less than you get a tighter bound than the real bound. So it would be inconsistent to use this form with lambda equals 2 pi over beta, actually. OK, so then there's some other functional form, which is related to this but different that has actually been computed by Maldacena et al. In using some ADS2 gravity dual for a conformal field of a given dimension. And if you use that functional form, you get the bound, the actual bound, 2 pi over beta. So more generally, there's a family of functional forms for which you can prove that the bound holds. Okay, and there's some simple condition that they satisfy. I don't know if that condition is physical or not, but it's very hard to find functional forms that do not satisfy that condition.
So you prove at which step that time is larger than TD enters?
So that enters because, so okay. In this product of four A's, this product of four R's will appear. And there are two terms here that correspond to these delta functions. Those will become products of two-point functions when plugged in here. Those are the quantities that decay on a timescale of TD.
So you have to somehow assume a form for FT so that you can use this lambda to govern the whole period of the whole function. But I mean, by definition, this for me is this lambda is just a behavior of intermediate behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it has nothing to do with like the tail.
Right, right. That's right.
So
you can introduce other parameters, for instance. So now the late time behavior will be something different. It'll involve a combination of lambda and this eta.
Okay.
That doesn't change this. So I would like to make this step a little more independent of the form. I don't know how to do it. I think it might not be possible to do because in general, large omega behavior of a Fourier transform is related to analytic behavior of a function. So what really matters is where this function becomes non-analytic in the complex D plane. That's not obviously connected to its intermediate time properties. But it appears that in all the cases that have been studied, it is somehow related.
Can you see how the scrambling time enters the fringes?
Yeah. So that's actually, I think that's a more interesting question than the bound itself, because the scrambling time must appear as some oscillation in this G function. And so it tells you something about the correlations of these R's.
Okay.
And that hasn't been studied, as far as I know. Like, no one has looked for that numerically in ETH on small systems. I don't know if that... So in spin systems, for instance, there's no large timescale hierarchy between the dissipation and scrambling times. So it might be interesting to see how this timescale appears in this function.
Just to make sure, so that equation with four R matrices is valid as long as time is larger than TD?
This?
Uh-huh.
No, this is just a general statement.
But if time is smaller than TD, and so can you explain how TD and TS enter?
Okay, imagine the equation was just this. I didn't have this third term. Right? So if I just had this part, then there would be a universal relationship between the two-point functions and the four-point functions in the system, which is just not true in general. So this term basically says how the four-point function is different from a product of two-point functions. TD is governed by F. So if you compute a two-point function, it's F squared that determines how quickly it falls off. So TD is hidden in F somehow. TS does not appear in the two-point function. So it's hidden in G somewhere.
So assuming ETH for CFT, then there's some relation between two point functions, four point functions. Can you obtain any structure?
I don't know. I haven't tried to do this for a CFT. Is there a universal relationship between the two and four point functions?
They split into many conformal blocks.
Uh-huh.
But you need like straight point quadratic functions as well.
But with that assumption of ETH, you can get any, it seems you can get any point function.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Okay, so the upshot of this part is that it's possible to derive this bound using ETH plus some knowledge of the functional form of the OTOC. That's, this derivation is somewhat orthogonal to the one originally given by Maldesane et al, which basically relied on some complex analysis arguments. Okay.
Just want to say you are also relying on the complex analysis.
I am relying on that to some extent, but I'm not, they also use large N factorization, which is not required here. So there's some differences.
So you said they also developed some form of FOTOC in their paper?
No, they don't require, in the original proof of the bound, there's no assumption on the functional form of F.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an assumption of large N factorization.
Mm-hmm. So that assumption is more than the separation between TD and TS?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. The assumption is basically that where you put these rows doesn't affect the value of this quantity.
Actually, in your these starting on the ETH, does it matter like how do you factorize your thermal ensemble? Like, say, can I just go to one and then make ETH 0?
You can't. You won't get the bound in this way of doing things.
So you have to assume that.
Yes. So actually, I don't think it's true in general that the normally, like the unregulated OTOC satisfies this bound. And there have been papers on this, actually, where people look at different regularizations and find different behavior.
Which paper?
I can find the reference afterwards. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I have it on my computer.
Well, we should be wrapping up, so maybe there are some final questions.
Okay.